At least since the invention of the wheel, people have fixed, tinkered with, and improved every device they've possessed. It's been a human right. But after several thousand years, suddenly legal clauses are being tucked in purchase agreements saying that today's owners of products must not even peek, much less poke inside, the inner workings of our devices. Makers of anything with a computer chip in it, everything from your car to your toothbrush, have been especially vehement about this, rewriting human nature by outlawing our right to repair. Yes, they assert, you own the thing, but we own the intangible ideas that make it work. So if the product malfunctions, you must return it to us and pay us a premium to repair it. Plus, they prattle, you could hurt yourself trying to do it yourself, so trust us. Bovine excrement, barks Steve Wozniak. Companies inhibit your rights so they can have power, control over everything. Is he some consumer radical? No, Wozniak is the co-founder of Apple, the multi-billion-dollar global Goliath that is the world's biggest producer of consumer electronics. He's appalled that Apple has now become a fierce opponent of self-repair. He says, we wouldn't have had an Apple, except that early innovators like him grew up in a very open technology world. From the start, he points out, openness helped spread innovation and consumer demand. So, why stop the self-repair community, he asks? Two big reasons. Besides letting corporations lock in monopoly profits from the repair industry, it also dissuades customers from bothering with repairs. Just throw the thing away and buy a new one. This is Jim Hightower saying, if you wonder where such massive, deadly levels of pollution by lead, mercury, plastic, etc. come from, look to the gross throwaway ethic of big tech profiteers like Apple. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you lowdowners who subscribe to our monthly newsletter, The Hightower Lowdown. You know who you are. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, friends out in Pittsburgh not happy this evening. Evidently, the KISS concert was postponed. Turns out Paul Stanley has COVID. And look, you know, as we talked about last week when I went to a concert and said how much care the artists took not to deal with people because they didn't want to get sick. Imagine all the workers who are not going to be able to work now because these concerts are going to be shut down because the artists are sick. We also find out that Ford Motor Company, evidently, they're delaying their return to work program from coming up here in October to January, which, again, takes me back to what do we do in the workplace? How do we make sure that our workers are protected? But just as important, how do we make sure that companies can stay open? If you can't get workers who are going to be healthy at work, what do you do? Here to share some thoughts on the fact that a lot of employers are going to begin mandating vaccines and what are the unions going to do about it? I've asked Wendell Young IV to come talk with us. Wendell is the president of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union Local 1776. They represent 35,000 Pennsylvania workers in retail, healthcare, manufacturing, and food processing. You know, the essential workers, the frontline heroes of last year. Wendell, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, how you doing? Thanks for inviting me tonight.
So I'm looking at this and I'm going, you know, what do we do? What the federal government's clearly not going to mandate people get vaccines. What's the carrot? What's the stick? How do we get people vaccinated?
Well, Rick, I think we're actually overdue for employers to start stepping up and mandating vaccinations. Now, I know that's not a popular thing among some people. You know, we have the anti-vaxxers out there. They all have some different motivations. Some have some in common. Some have some different ideas. Everything from the ridiculous about microchips being inserted in the vaccine to just plain ignorance. And a lot of it driven by information sources that are far from factual. But the bottom line is this: you mentioned the kind of workers we represent, and overwhelming majority of our members, almost all of our essential workers, they've worked through last year. They did an outstanding job. Throughout their, all Pennsylvania and their communities, but they can't do it alone. And there's just too many people still not getting vaccinated. You know, right now we have the Delta variant, a few other strains out there. I'm not a healthcare expert, but you know, I think like many people, I followed this well enough to know that the longer this virus is active, and the more active it is, the more it's going to splinter into more variants. Right now, the vaccinations that are in use, authorized by the FDA, are protecting us against the Delta variant. But what about the next variant or the one after that? What if one comes out resistant to vaccination? We've already had close to, 700,000 people in this country killed by this virus, millions across the planet. How bad does this have to get before people wake up? So, you know, there's folks that talk about people's rights and that it's, you know, my body, my right, and they're correct about that. But rights have limits, and those limitations we see all the time. I've been talking about this for a long time now. You know, you don't have the right to smoke at work because secondhand smoke can adversely affect people's health. Well, you don't have the right to come to work infected with COVID-19 and in the middle of a global pandemic that's killing record numbers of people. You don't have the right to put your coworkers at risk. You know, as a union, one of our basic fundamental responsibilities is to make sure that workplaces are safe. That was one of the early reasons why people formed unions in the first place,
right?
To provide workplace safety, and making sure that that workplace is as free and clear as possible of people who are infected or potentially infected in the middle of a pandemic is the best way we can make sure that our workers are safe. So it's pretty clear now. The evidence is overwhelming that the vaccinations in use here in the United States are working. The current crisis of this pandemic is one of the unvaccinated, caused by the unvaccinated, and the responsibility of the unvaccinated to do something about it. But, you know, those holdouts, whether it's 10% at a workplace or 30% or 50%, you know, they've had the opportunity to do this on their own and get there. And the fact that they're not means that employers need to step up. And I mean all employers, not just private sector, public sector, schools, everyone needs to step up and say, if you want to enter this place, you need to be vaccinated. You know, you have options in which vaccination. You have to do it. You have to do it not only to protect the other workers there because of potential breakthrough infections, but those workers who are vaccinated, who might have a compromised immune system because of an organ transplant they underwent or a cancer treatment, and just use a few examples that might be compromising their immune system or some other underlying healthcare issue that compromised that immune system, they shouldn't have to be at risk because of people who refuse to get vaccinated.
No, I'm right there with you. Now, yeah, when you look at this,
that's where I am.
No, and this is good. I'm glad there are some union leaders who are coming out and finally saying, no, we're going to take a stand on this, because I've had a number of my union brothers and sisters going, well, my union should represent my right to not have it. So how do you deal with that situation when it's your responsibility to represent each and every member, and one of your members is saying, no, you represent me, I don't want it. How do you do that?
No, you see, you can't pander to every individual. That's not possible. And that's what some people are doing. They're worried about that vocal minority of people who are not vaccinated and say, hell no, never going to do it. Because this issue was politicized by Republicans, by conservatives, and by Donald Trump. You know, this is the only thing like this that's ever happened, and it's because of the approach that Donald Trump took last year. Now, I know I don't want to get hung up on politics, but that's why we're in this situation.
Right.
So when it comes to workplace safety, I do believe by taking a position, whether it's a union leader or a business executive suite, the top management, that they are looking out for everyone's best interests. I've had this conversation with a few of our members. You know, a few of our members who have heard my stance on this have reached out to me. I've had some good dialogue with them. We have to look out for the greater good of folks. I'm not telling people you must get vaccinated. The folks who are saying it's my body, my choice, you're right. But you do not have the right to put other people's health and safety at risk. You do not have the right to come to work and possibly pass this on to someone else who is vaccinated or not, and then take it home to a family member who is vulnerable, who with a compromised immune system and or with children who are not old enough to be vaccinated. You do not have that right. You cannot bring toxins into the workplace. You're not allowed to bring weapons into the workplace. You're not allowed to shoot off guns into the air. Your right to bear arms means you can own them, but you have to be responsible with them. And those same kind of responsibilities that come in a democracy like ours for the greater good of the community apply here. You do not have the right to put other people at risk. So I'm not saying you have to get vaccinated. What I'm saying is if you don't come to work and do what's necessary to help protect everybody else, then you don't work. If you work in one of my meat cutting facilities, you got to put on chain mail and other safety equipment before you're allowed to go on that line. You have to operate the saws and the knives and the things on that line to help keep the person next to you safe so you don't injure them. And if you don't do that, you're not allowed to work. That extends to COVID-19 also.
No, I'm right there with you. But, you know, we're in this moment, Wendell, and it's really a bizarre time where people think that their freedom to not have to put just a piece of cloth over their face to not, you know, get other people sick, that their freedom is sacrosanct, but everyone else's freedom to be free from infection, that doesn't matter. I'm not quite sure how we got here. I know it's been 40 years of Reagan, the individual's important and all that, but we're in this weird spot.
There's two things I fault for how we got here. One is just plain old ignorance. They didn't pay attention to civics class. You don't have the right to do anything you want. There's limits that come and responsibilities that come with our freedom. There are limits and responsibilities that come with our freedom, and there's no better time than now to stand up and act responsibly and understand those limits, because those limits help keep all of us safe. Just because you have a car and a driver's license, you can't drive down city street at 90 miles an hour. There's limits and there are restrictions, and that applies here. Second, now, I believe this was during the Reagan administration, when the fairness doctrine was eliminated from news and broadcasting, and it became the wild, wild west in the digital space as well as in the print space of information sources, because I don't call them news. Every information source is not news, and today, with a smartphone, with a computer, a tablet, everyone can log on and find the information they want to hear and supports their biased position. That doesn't make it news and it doesn't make it factual. So, you know, it, again, comes back to ignorance. And, you know, there's an old saying we all learned when we were a little kid from our grandparents. Ignorance is bliss. These people are extremely happy living in their ignorance.
And they're proud to scream it as loudly as they can if you've been paying attention to some of these school board meetings. Last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, I'm looking at this and I'm going, you know, how much does our government have responsibility in this? And ultimately, does it have to fall to the private sector and to employers to implement this, since there is such distrust and disdain in this moment for our government?
Well, it does fall to the private sector. It falls to local governments, school boards. But, you know, look what's happening. We had a governor who was amongst, I think, the best in managing this last year. You know, we certainly didn't know enough about this. And I mean, everybody didn't know enough about this in the beginning of this pandemic. But, you know, based on what we learned, when we learned we had a governor here, Governor Wolf, who took some very aggressive steps, amongst the best we saw governors doing. And then we had a legislature dominated by the opposite party, who passed the law, through the ballot process, passed the law to prevent him or to undo any executive orders he issues. So they've tied his hands. And so there's really not a lot he can do, which is even why it's more important that whether it's school boards, cities, municipalities, counties, private employers, not-for-profits step up and do it. And you see them doing, you know, in recent weeks and even every day, more and more companies. Yesterday we saw news Delta Airlines is imposing a $200 monthly surcharge on employees' health care. Now, I've had a couple of members who are not vaccinated. I had a couple of members say to me how outrageous they thought my position was. Only a few, about 35,000. I had about 12 people directly contact me. Now my reps run into a few more, but still a small percentage overall right. of people. And I say to them, well, who's going to pay for this? Because the typical case, non hospitalized and treated for COVID-19 per person is about $115,000. If you go into the ICU and or on a ventilator, now you're talking $150,000 to $350,000 per person. Who's going to pay for it? Should the people that did all the right things and got vaccinated pay for it? Or do we charge, we take all that money and surcharge just those people that are not vaccinated?
No, I'm with you. And I said yesterday when I saw the story, I don't think $200 is near enough. It should be much more of that just because of the numbers that you laid out. And I've also gone as far as saying that at some point, especially when you look at the southern states that are just riddled with this, at some point you got to start turning people away. Say, sorry, you didn't get vaccinated. You didn't protect yourself. Sorry, we're not helping you.
So to get to the point, there's a responsible way to do this. I think we should have already started doing this, but yeah. I've urged all of our employers to begin mandatory vaccination programs, which would provide for, and I want to be clear here, a very limited space for exceptions for longstanding religious beliefs, which are not the person's personal beliefs. It's got to be a tenet of that religion. And you have to have joined it before last week or last month, right, or during the pandemic. It's got to be something that's long established. That's the legal standard. So you see the Catholic Church and most archdioceses have come out, and the Pope has come out and said, look, we're not going to help people with these kind of exceptions because our church is not against these. We support these for the greater good of people.
Right.
And the other would be, you know, if you have a medical condition, it really falls into the two examples that I already spoke about. It's primarily, not limited to, but mostly people who have gotten organs, who are organ recipients, and people with compromised immune systems, mostly due to certain cancer treatments. You know, they're the two categories. And even a lot of doctors are coming out now and saying, even with a compromised immune system, you should probably get vaccinated in a lot of these scenarios because, you know, you provide some protection, even if not as good as for other people. That it's very specific to certain conditions, not all conditions. So there's a way to do this. There's a way to screen. And then there's a way to test those who initially refuse. And I am a strong believer in giving people some incentives. There's a number of ways to provide incentives as a carrot, as an attaboy for stepping up and doing the right thing. But I also think that there ought to be penalties for those who don't, except for those who meet the legitimate exceptions. Even those who are granted exceptions, we still have to test frequently to prove, to be able to prove frequently. And that's going to depend on the workplace. You know, in a retail environment, I would say at least once a week, and that test has got to be in before the schedule's posted, or you're not on the schedule for the whole week. And it's a pain. It's going to be a pain in the neck for people to go get all this testing done. So if you provide some carrots, some sticks, if you continually do not show up for work because you fail to be tested, I would say you're considered AWOL. I mean, it's fine if an employer is going to fire people for not coming to work, but I think this is a choice individuals are making. And if they make the choice not to come to work, at some point you get replaced.
Yep. No, I'm right there with you. And good on you for this stance. I think more people have to come out and make this stance.
I got to tell you, Rick, I've had far more people reach out to me, and my reps are hearing it, for the very solid majority of people who have already gotten vaccinated or are fearful for their family and themselves and their kids and their moms and dads that they take care of. They're glad that people are stepping up and demanding this now. You know, it's the vocal minority who is causing all this flack. It's the vocal minority that people are pandering to. And I don't think we should pander to them. I think they've had enough time to do the right thing.
Yep. Right there with you. Good on you. I appreciate the time. I appreciate the article. I hope folks will take a look at your most recent op-ed over at BillyPenn.com. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at Wendell Young, the fourth's op-ed. Wendell, I appreciate the time. Great talking with you.
Yeah, you too, Rick. Take care. Be safe.
You as well. Again, we'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at it's time for all employers to mandate the COVID vaccine for workers. Written by Wendell Young, the fourth. Quick break, right back. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1922. That was the day 1,300 workers from four railroad brotherhoods walked off the job in Joliet, Illinois, near Chicago. The walkout threatened to paralyze freight service for steel mills in nearby Gary and other regional industries. 400,000 railroad shopmen had been on strike across the country for nearly 7 weeks. Newspaper headlines that day warned a general strike of 2 million trademen loomed on the horizon. Brotherhood leaders promised sympathy strikes in response to threats made against their members by troops on duty at railroad centers and yards. There were also real concerns about the health and safety of trainmen, given rolling stock was no longer being maintained. In Joliet, workers stayed away under threats from troops. Additionally, Illinois Central trainmen faced threats from striking miners throughout Kentucky and Illinois who warned, "Stop transporting non-union coal or suffer the consequences." Resentment had been building up against state guard troops stationed in Illinois yards. Earlier in the week, striking shopmen had engaged in a fatal confrontation with Joliet sheriffs that left a striker and a railroad detective dead and scores injured. Riot orders were called when authorities sought to arrest striking shopmen who had stormed the home of a scab. Brotherhood workers refused to return to work unless the troops were removed. Warren Stone, president of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, stated, quote, "We are not going to have our men shot up or beaten up or threatened by armed guards at railroad shops and yards. When the men cannot go to work without having irresponsible armed guards endangering their lives, they may go home and stay there. There will be 100 more cases soon if conditions are not changed." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, COVID cases jumping. Hospitalizations way up. Turns out we're above 100,000 hospitalizations due to COVID for the first time since January. You look at places like Mississippi that have opened parking garages as makeshift hospital wards. You look at Arkansas, who says they can't handle any more people into their ICU. You look at Alabama, that's completely out of ICU beds. And you go down to the states, you know, they're all struggling. You know, Idaho, as I said yesterday, they're looking to start going, we're going to have to start rationing. We're going to have to start turning people away. Orlando. I mean, this is the freaking Orlando. They've stopped doing water treatment because the liquid oxygen that they use to treat the water with, they need for people in the hospitals. And someone told me that there's now a water advisory going on because they're taking the short term. This is in the United States of America, where we're literally hours away from moving anything around. And they're taking it from the water supply to put into, we're not flying it from somewhere else. And the truth of the matter is everyone else is going, holding on to mine. Because if it gets bad enough there, eventually it's going to come our way and we're going to have to deal with it. All because these southern states, all because these red states, these Trump states, with their horrible vaccination rates, are now spiking. Mississippi has got the highest infection rate per 100,000 people of 114. Nationwide, it's the average is 46 people per 100,000, which is not horrible. I mean, hospitalization rate. These are the people who are in hospitals. The number of people who are these new COVID cases going up. Mississippi, Florida, Louisiana, Kentucky, South Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia, Arkansas. Those are our top nine. All of them above 70 per 100,000 of infections. And only, one of them? Florida, above 50% of their population vaccinated, and Florida's only at 52%. Mississippi's at 37%. and you wonder why they're number one. It's crazy. I mean, it's really just crazy. And it's not like they didn't have the chance. It's not like it wasn't abundant. And what's happening, and we're seeing reports of this every day, you're getting medical professionals are going, you know what? We lived through the last year. We're not doing it again. You got people who are burnt out. You got people who are going, you know, the heck with it. I'm looking at, there's part of me goes, man, I wish I was a nurse. I could make a killing. I could make tons of money. Because they're offering, Nebraska was offering $40,000 just to sign on. An immediate sign-on bonus. And you didn't even have to be vaccinated. They were going, no, come, you could be unvaccinated. We need people to take care of people. This is what happens when you, on a policy level, fail. And this, again, has everything to do with you. Look at those 9 states. Every one of them has a Republican governor. Every one of them has a Republican legislature. Every one of them were pushing mask bans. Every one of them were telling, no, we're not going to close down. Every one of them were doing all of the things that you're not supposed to do. Now, I include Louisiana as a Republican governor because a Louisiana Democrat's kind of like a Republican in my view. But this is one of those moments where you just go, time to start building walls. And the fear has always been, this is not new. None of this stuff's new. The fear has always been, what happens when we overtax our healthcare system? What happens when doctors and nurses and folks go, enough? What's going to happen to our healthcare system when people are no longer able to do and get the other procedures that they need? Someone pointed out to me today that, you think of these surgeons, people who do hip replacements, people who do knee operations, people who do, whatever you need done. In these states, they can't do them because all of the healthcare facilities are taken up by COVID patients. So you've got this unequal system where you've got all these professionals who, they're not doing their thing because we're too busy, all hands on deck, taking care of people who, for the most part, and there was a Deaconess Hospital, I think it's in Indiana. They came out with a little infograph where of all the people in their, let's say there's 100 people in their ICU. Like 5 of them were vaccinated. Everybody else was unvaccinated. Let's say they had, 20 people died. 2 of them were unvaccinated or were vaccinated. Everybody else was unvaccinated. I mean, it's a pretty duh. This is duh. And yet duh seems to be going, I'm not going to get vaccinated. I'll drink bleach. Give me the worm medicine meant for actual sheep. I mean, isn't it amazing? I mean, really stop and think about it for a second. Some of the things that people are pitching. I know people, and this is one of those weird moments. I know people who had to take the hydroxychloroquine because it's actually a drug that is used for malaria and helps to treat lupus and a couple other things that they use it for. And what people were saying is when you take this drug, there's like a massive adjustment period. Like your body's really messed up. And I'm going, explain to me why you would take that, but not the vaccine. I mean, I'm literally stumped. Why you would go, and there were people who drank bleach. Or take the silver stuff that the guy on TV is hawking. Who knows what that is? And now this thing for deworming livestock? You're going to take that off the shelf from the local tractor supply? Seriously? You're going to get that from the local Walmart in the giant tub size? Well, I'm going to protect myself. Got it on sale at Walmart. We're going to buy some crap off the shelf at Walmart, but not get the vaccine. It's freaking nuts. I would love someone to justify it. I would just love to say, no, the Walmart thing is good because the Waltons, they hired a private investigator. Jeez. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
This is going to be the last chance for a decade, probably, for anything big at the federal level to happen. So the stakes are enormous.
Crunch time for climate action as House Democrats advance budget reconciliation blueprint.
More than 220 people were killed and dozens of buildings were destroyed in what's being described as a once-in-400-year event.
Yep, man-made global warming made Europe's catastrophic flooding much more catastrophic. Plus, good news for breathers in Louisiana. Officials put brakes on construction of massive plastic factory.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Also funding for electric school buses. And to make it even more environmentally friendly, the bullies will shoot spitballs at you with paper straws.
Well, that seems right. This is your Green News Report.
And the wedgies will be gluten-free.
Okay, Desi Doyen, crunch time indeed as we get closer and closer to this massive infrastructure package, which, yeah, I think it's going to pass.
Well, we shall see. House Democrats this week narrowly approved that $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation blueprint, the next step in the arduous process of advancing President Biden's ambitious agenda to expand the social safety net and climate action.
Well, I didn't say it was going to be easy. I just said it's going to pass.
The smaller bipartisan infrastructure bill will get a House vote by late September. But now the House must write the budget legislation, which Senate Democrats can pass with a simple majority vote. That means that it really is crunch time for climate. That's according to energy journalist David Roberts of the Volt newsletter on a recent broadcast. Roberts says that public pressure can ensure the inclusion of two key proposals to clean up the electric grid, a national clean electricity standard and clean energy tax credits that energy analysts say will accelerate decarbonization in transportation and buildings.
If you move the other two big chunks of emissions over onto the electricity grid, then you see, oh, having a clean electricity grid is the core strategy for decarbonization. This is the sector that's going to clean up all the other sectors.
And it will be a very big deal when and if this bill passes.
In other news, an extreme event attribution study of the catastrophic European floods in July has concluded that, yes, man-made global warming boosted both the likelihood and the severity of the rains that caused the deadly flooding that killed at least 220 people in Germany and Belgium alone. Scientists at the World Weather Attribution Network found that the flood event was made up to 9 times more likely than it would have been without man-made climate change. One river basin might have seen a 1 in 15,000 year event.
You know, it was an unbelievable flooding event, just wiped out really entire towns, and we've already moved on to the next disaster, the next dozen or so.
Speaking of, here in the U.S., 9 national forests have been closed due to wildfires in the exceptionally hot and dry West. Officials warn that California's monstrous Caldor fire is on the verge of threatening the Lake Tahoe Basin. And in Minnesota, officials have ordered a temporary emergency closure of the popular Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. They're evacuating visitors due to 3 wildfires within its boundaries, fueled by heat, wind, and drought.
In Minnesota.
But some good news, the Interior Department has raised the pay of nearly all of the federal government's wildland firefighters to $15 an hour. The Federal Aviation Administration has announced $20 million in grants to help airports replace equipment to go from polluting and low-tech to zero-emissions vehicles and electrify equipment that currently relies on fossil fuels. And bonus, it will create construction jobs. More good news, President Biden has nominated Charles Sams III for director of the National Park Service. If confirmed, he will be the first Native American ever to lead the National Park Service.
That is good news.
And finally, in southern Louisiana, in a major win for environmental justice activists and members of the majority black community of St. James Parish, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has announced that a truly massive plastics manufacturing plant proposed by Taiwan-based giant Formosa Plastics Group must now undergo a full, formal environmental review. The decision deals a significant blow to the $10 billion project. Environmental groups say if built, the facility would double local toxic air pollution, release greenhouse gas emissions equivalent to 3 coal-fired power plants every year, and would rank among the largest pollution-generating plastics facilities on the planet.
That is good news. Too much good news for the Green News Report. Something must have gone wrong. We need to take some time off. For much more on all of those stories until we're back, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, again, a horribly tragic day. And let me reiterate the reality. Anyone who took today as an opportunity to attack Joe Biden or attack someone that you don't agree with politically and they use our soldiers as the fodder for that, I find it disgraceful. Wholly un-American and unpatriotic. It is flat wrong. But sadly, I've had so many people, throw arrows at me and things that I've seen that I guess this is the country that we are now. Sad, scary stuff. Here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, I've asked our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst Bob Ney to come talk. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So, horribly tragic day today, and sadly, I mean, predictable. I think this was something that was predictable. In fact, they were actually, trying to prepare for it, but just the wrong time to go, in my view, to go on the attack against Biden.
Something that amazed me, I'm a little bit lost for words, speaking about this, but something that amazed me is, posting, thinking about our soldiers, posting that, just simply that phrase, say a prayer for the soldiers. And the next thing you know, people are coming on and it becomes the, Biden criticize moment. And I'm thinking, can't they just take a second to think about what happened, without trying to put something political out there?
Yep.
It stuns me.
No, it's shocking in that, I know everyone wants to get the first hot take and they want to get the most clicks and the most likes and all of that. But, I don't know. I was talking earlier about, 9/11. And I remember, look, I didn't vote for Bush. I didn't like Bush. I definitely didn't like Cheney. But in that moment, I'm like, dude, I'm behind you. What are we doing? You're the president. Which lead the way. Now, clearly, over the next months and years, that waned.
Right.
But in that moment, in that hot moment, you came together.
We all dispersed from the Capitol at that point in time when we were told the plane was, coming from within Pennsylvania to the Capitol, and then people eventually gathered back to a place near the Capitol and. But I remember finally when everything was done, we left the Capitol, and I got into a taxi, and I can remember the taxi driver looking at me, and he saw the members' pin, you know, and he knew what that was, that pin, security pin members wear. And he said, you know, he said, today, he said, we're not black or white, and he said, we're not Democrat or Republican, we're all American. I remember that. I mean, very clearly, you know, the taxi driver saying that. And today, probably you get in the taxi and it would be some comment about, you know, Biden.
Yeah.
It's changed. And I was stunned today at, you know, trying to, again, post, you know, thinking of our soldiers. And the next thing you know, it becomes a free-for-all on President Biden.
And look, I thought Biden did the right thing today. I think him coming out and saying ultimately he's responsible for what happens. And, you know, I think in the moment, being the compassionate, empathetic person that he is, I think you need that a little bit. But also coming and saying, look, we're going to find who did this, and we're going to take care of him.
Well, yes, and here's the thing, too. You know, he didn't take the bait. And when I say that, you know, people wanted him to immediately, you know, launch missiles to, you know, send the troops down the streets of Kabul. And he didn't take the bait. And the reason I say that is that, you know, to get off this mission, if he had done that, would have been the worst move possibly that the United States could have made.
Yeah.
It would have stopped, you know, everything they're trying to do to get Americans and Afghans out of there. So, you know, he did the right thing, and he made it clear. You know, he doesn't know when right now, but at some point in time, you know, we will seek revenge for those who, you know, try to do these things to us.
Now, I said earlier that I would be okay with bombing the hell out of an ISIS stronghold to keep them running
right
in that direction while we get our people out. But he didn't do that. And I think calmer heads, try and get your folks out. I mean, we've gotten over 100,000 people out over the last couple of weeks,
mm-hmm.
Which is a massive undertaking, and no casualties that I've heard of. You moved 100,000 people and nothing. I think that's really impressive.
Oh, it is. I mean, this is a tough time. It's a tough place. They're basically surrounded at the airport. And then on top of it, when, you know, people say, well, can't they just people go meet in the outskirts? You know, it's a very difficult terrain over there. Very difficult. And
yeah.
I mean, what are people going to go up into the mountains? Can't do that. So, you know, they're in a disadvantage in the first place. And they've maintained, they, meaning, you know, the military, the, you know, everybody involved at the airport, have maintained, I think, the best possible scenario for something that is the least ideal scenario to be in over there.
No, what's interesting to me is, in watching some of the comments, I sadly, and this again goes to our lack of depth when you talk about issues, I don't think most people know there's a difference between ISIS and the Taliban.
Well, that's the other thing, too. You know, there's ISIS, ISIS-K, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and like people will generically say, oh, you know, the Iranians are tight with Al-Qaeda. No, they aren't. This is a very complicated situation over there with groups that don't like each other. ISIS doesn't like the Taliban, et cetera. And if you just turn and try to take some kind of action today, who do you take it on? How do you tell who is whom? You know, we can't.
Right, because they're not all wearing uniforms.
Exactly.
And, you know, there's, sadly, you know, there's part of me that, and this is a horrible thing to think, but, you know, look, there's a lot of money in war. There are a lot of defense contracts in war. There's a lot of people here in this country that don't want us to get out, that want us to turn around and do what would have been the worst possible thing and say, oh, they attacked us, we're going to turn around and go back. There's a lot of people who would make a lot of money off of that.
Right. And, you know, today some of the criticism, I can't remember which Republican leader, but said, you know, they needed to pass some kind of legislation that would say that, you know, we don't leave till, you know, the last Americans out. Well, nobody has said that we're going to stop trying to get Americans out. Nobody has said that. you know, from the White House down. And so, you know, for the reaction after the death of our soldiers to be, you know, we need to pass a law. They've got to be kidding.
Yeah, and what good is a law over there?
Pass the law. You know, everybody is trying to do what they can do over there to make sure people, you know, are getting out of the country. So I thought the president's response was good. It's a healing moment also, which is what I think he was also, you know, attempting to convey and conveyed, you know, a healing moment. You could, you know, his son was in service, and, you know, this is a true feeling for the president about the soldiers and what happened to them.
Yeah, I just find it disgraceful, some of the stuff that came out today, and you know, I just find it disgraceful.
I know. Like I said, it took me by surprise. I thought that, I don't know why, I probably naively thought that, you know, we would think about the soldiers for a second and try to band together to make sure that everybody stays unified about, you know, Americans getting out, because the worst thing we can do is to show the enemies over there that we are fractionalized over here.
Well, I think that ship is long sailed.
Right.
I do. I think that ship's long sailed, and I think it's something that that Putin and Russia and China and North Korea and Iran and all these places have done a masterful job exploiting through our social media.
Right.
Because the bots were crazy today. The number of bots that were out there pushing. Now, look, I don't know how many of the comments were made by actual American citizens. But there were a lot of social media posts, you know, pushing this this narrative. They go back and Joe Biden's weak and should resign and needs to be impeached and all of that stuff. Today's not the day for that.
Right. Exactly.
Let's move along. I wanted to get your thoughts on this Lauren Boebert story. Evidently, you know, gun fetish Barbie has got her things in a twist here. Evidently, the husband Jason has made, I think they're saying something along the lines of $900,000 over the last 2 years, and this state representative is filing a formal ethics complaint, saying that the average person doing the job that he does in the oil and gas fields makes somewhere between $41,000 and $84,000, with the top folks at the very top making $174,000. You know, how is it over these 2 years, while she's in Congress, he's making $450,000 a year? This seems a little fishy to me.
Yes, you know, this was information she did not reveal while on the campaign trail, but she just revealed this in the new financial disclosure form is how it came out. And that was Tuesday that she filed it. And he did receive $478,000 from a group called Terra Energy Productions for consulting services is all that it said. And $460,000 from the same firm in 2019. And of course, she is a first-term lawmaker. And again, during her 2020 campaign, she did not disclose those earnings. So this is something, you know, new. And then they talked about, you know, that he's worked for 18 years, you know, in the industry. But of course, people will look towards, you know, And I've seen this happen before with, you know, people that are related or relatives of, you know, either kind of indirect or direct relatives of members that all of a sudden were paid a fee that was, you know, beyond the normal consulting fee for someone.
Yeah, $450,000 a year.
That's a lot.
That seems a bit excessive, especially in down years because of the pandemic. Drilling activity, you know, nationwide slumped. You know, we weren't doing as much. It seems a bit excessive. So you know, what could she end up being charged with? What could she end up? What negative could happen to her if it comes out that this was kind of a bribe?
Well, the new financial disclosure form was filed after the Federal Elections Commission asked the campaign why the campaign sent her $6,650 via Venmo in four different transactions in May and June. And the campaign said, well, those were made in error and had been refunded. So that's what actually had, you know, had started the inquiry. Then when that inquiry started, it was noted that she had not filed and then revealed this new financial form, which brought him, you know, into it. Now, the only thing that could happen is if they could make a direct correlation that, you know, she somehow, you know, used her influence, or he used the fact that she's his wife, and that's how he, you know, got the advanced salary. Yeah. Otherwise, there's probably not, you know, much.
So nothing here, you think? I mean, you're usually somebody who usually, you know, drills down to the bottom. Anything here?
Well, I don't think it, unless they have a, well, first of all, I think obviously because he is her husband, he probably got an outrageous salary compared to what he would have gotten if he wasn't married to her. So I think there's something there that doesn't look or smell right, but they would almost have to have it pinpointed that, you know, they've got to have an email or something pinpointed that he was given that because of, you know, her influence.
Right. Last thing I wanted to ask you about, seven Capitol Police officers today filed a lawsuit against the former guy, you know, the Oath Keepers, the, you know, the Proud Boys, the Roger Stone, I guess all in all, like 20 members of right-wing extreme groups, political organizations, operatives, and all of this stuff. Can the Capitol Police sue for this?
Well, actually, they can. They're suing, of course, you know, former President Donald Trump. Now, when it comes to suing Trump, there may be a problem. They'll still file the suit anyway to make a point. There might be a problem because of some presidential, you know, immunity of sort. But I think that, you know, when they file the suit, obviously they can do discovery, which would be one point of why you would want to do a lawsuit, to try to, you know, do some discovery. But also other people, you know, they filed, as you said, on the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, and they can do that. There's no reason that they couldn't. And, you know, try to at least maybe get some discovery on it and find out who did what and when. So I think that it's, you know, worth the filing of the officers to do that.
No, I'm looking forward to discovery.
Right. I think it's well worth them to file. And the point that they make, you know, off of this, somebody should be sued for what happened that day. And it's a wonder that, you know, more officers weren't killed that day.
No, absolutely. I'm amazed that there wasn't more bloodshed that day.
Right.
Considering all the people who had guns walking around there and the restraint of the Capitol Police. And I think part of, again, we've talked about this before. I think part of the restraint was that they feared they were outgunned. If they were going to get into a gun battle and just, you know, took the abuse.
Right. I wish somebody would sue Rudy for shaving at a table.
I saw that. I'm like, you know,
I thought about that today. I don't know why. I was sitting in the doctor's office and I started thinking about Rudy Giuliani at the table. And I'm thinking somebody ought to sue him for, I don't know, everything.
Oh, they are. Dominion is doing that as we speak.
Right, but suing for more.
There you go.
You know?
Rudy.
Oh, my.
But as
always,
Bob, I appreciate the time. Great stuff.
Thank you. Thank you, Rick.
Yeah, I saw have you seen the video of Rudy Giuliani doing the shaving at the table at the airport? Somebody shot a video of it. I'm going, you know, they have bathrooms for that. You know, you could go into the bathroom and do it. You don't need to do it right there because, you know, interestingly enough, in this moment of airborne, you know, pathogens running around, do you really want Rudy's stubble in with your soup? But again, these people don't care about us. They don't, it's all about them, man. It's all about them. And to reiterate Bob's point, I hope Dominion voting systems, I hope they sue them for every penny they've got. Because ultimately, I think that's what's going to end up taking a lot of them down. I don't know our justice system is going to do it. I think they'll be able to hire lawyers and push this stuff off for potentially years and years. and they'll probably be dead before they're held accountable. But suing them, I don't know. I think that's a pretty good a pretty good idea, and good on the Capitol Police for who did that. Since we're talking about Rudy, let's finish up on I think my favorite story of the day. Nothing more punk rock than this. Evidently, you may remember the Four Seasons Total Landscaping place where Rudy had the the press conference, you know, right across the street from the porno shop. An actual landscaping. He thought it was the Four Seasons Hotel. Turns out it was a landscaping business that they set up in the parking lot. Well, the people who own the Four Seasons Total Landscaping business, along with the giant parking lot, over the weekend they had a punk rock concert where they brought in Brandon Kelly and Laura Jane Grace for a day. And it's one of these things where I'm going, I now got to get one of those concert T-shirts. I wish I would have known. Wish I'd have been there. The best part of it is, though, they had a life-size cutout of Rudy Giuliani that they were doing crowd surfing with. And it's one of those, if anyone's ever been to a punk show, you know, people go stage diving and then you're crowd surfing and people move you along until, not me, I've never done that because I always thought it would be like Parting of the Sea. You would jump and everyone would go, oh, no, and they would run and then you'd face plant right under the ground. So I've never done it. But to see, you know, the crowd surfing Rudy, I thought that was pretty funny. Also, people taking selfies with garden tools. That was kind of funny. Kind of funny and well worth the interesting day. And thank you, Rudy, for doing that. Thanks for having the press conference there and looking ridiculous. Gave us lots of interesting frames. Now, some of the thoughts of the people who were there, you know, it's historic. It was Shakespearean, they said. Epic, amazing were some of the responses. I think it's just pretty cool that you know, you throw it out there. Good on them. But I do got to get one of the T-shirts. I got to do it. Got to do it. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, thericksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1922. That was the day 1,300 workers from four railroad brotherhoods walked off the job in Joliet, Illinois, near Chicago. The walkout threatened to paralyze freight service for steel mills in nearby Gary and other regional industries. 400,000 railroad shopmen had been on strike across the country for nearly 7 weeks. Newspaper headlines that day warned a general strike of 2 million tradesmen loomed on the horizon. Brotherhood leaders promised sympathy strikes in response to threats made against their members by troops on duty at railroad centers and yards. There were also real concerns about the health and safety of trainmen, given rolling stock was no longer being maintained. In Joliet, workers stayed away under threats from troops. Additionally, Illinois Central trainmen faced threats from striking miners throughout Kentucky and Illinois who warned, "Stop transporting non-union coal or suffer the consequences." Resentment had been building up against state guard troops stationed in Illinois yards. Earlier in the week, striking shopmen had engaged in a fatal confrontation with Joliet sheriffs that left a striker and a railroad detective dead and scores injured. Riot orders were called when authorities sought to arrest striking shopmen who had stormed the home of a scab. Brotherhood workers refused to return to work unless the troops were removed. Warren Stone, president of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, stated, quote, "We are not going to have our men shot up or beaten up or threatened by armed guards at railroad shops and yards. When the men cannot go to work without having irresponsible armed guards endangering their lives, they may go home and stay there. There will be 100 more cases soon if conditions are not changed." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistyin2.com.